Okay, this might be the only one that we listen to where I'm like a little embarrassed by it. That's okay. Let's do it. I didn't take it off the internet, so it's fair game.
My name is Ian. I am here with Sharon Reynolds from SBL, and we are hanging out with the one and only Nick Campbell. Now, you know Nick from his killer Playing with Scary Pockets, Charlie Puth, Pomplamoose, Wolfpack, Megan Trainor, and Theo Katzman, among many others. He's, of course, a bass player and a sideman, but also a band leader and composer writing music under the name Nick Campbell Destroys, which also just so happens to be his Instagram handle. In addition to being a freak show player, he's a fantastic educator, and Sharon and I have pulled up a few YouTube videos of the amazing things you've played, Nick, and we're going to get into it right now.
Sick.
Now.
Sick.
Are you ready?
Yeah, I hope so.
Dude, bass in hand. You've got the bass. You're like primed, playing position, ready to go. Check this out.
Did a fool.
This is so funky.
Oh, Nick. Thanks, man. Yeah, this one turned out really good. I remember after we recorded this one, I was like, this is pretty good.
Like your muted thumb thing is crazy.
Oh, man. Well, thanks, dude. Yeah, I have a whole story about how I kind of like learned how to do that. That's actually pretty funny.
Oh, my God.
Well, we can't wait. But before we hear the story, we have to hear this chorus. Because this sound you get on the chorus, I have so many questions.
Don't show up, don't come, don't stop caring about me now.
God damn it. Oh, do it in the cowbell.
Don't stop caring.
Oh, the descending thing.
Aren't you the guy?
Oh my God.
Damn it, Nick! Dude! Okay, like, I didn't see this in real time.
Yeah.
And I'm a huge fan of your playing. I've seen you live. I mean, like, I've seen all the stuff on SBL. This, I don't know how I missed this, but when Sharon and I were pulling up all these links, we came across this and I was like, oh my God. Like, we just sat and watched it and we didn't say anything to each other other than like, oh, like we just grunted.
Like ugly cries and like sounds coming out.
Oh, well, thanks, guys.
Man, I mean, can I start out asking you about like your muted thumb approach? Yeah, how do you approach that?
I got hip to that because my senior year of high school, right as I was about to go into college, I went to USC for music, and like maybe like 3 months before the school year ended, I did this master class at this other high school. I participated in this masterclass. I didn't give a masterclass because I was 17. I was like, not that good. And obviously I was like learning. But Marcus Miller was the bass player who was like leading the masterclass. They had a bunch of different like super heavy session and jazz instrumentals, like leading combos and stuff like that. It was kind of like a citywide, like small little jazz student festival masterclass thing. And a lot of the cats who were there, like they weren't like going to go to music school. Or like they were just younger, you know, they hadn't figured out like what they were going to do yet. They were still kind of getting into jazz. And like, I was already like super into it. So I spent a lot of time with Marcus hanging out with him, like one-on-one during that masterclass.
And,
which was like a big, huge, I mean, still am obviously, but like a huge fan. It was like an amazing thing for me. And I'm sure he probably, I don't know if he remembers, you know, I'm sure he's done a million of those kinds of things. And, but for me, it was a hugely impactful thing. And I'll never forget. They wanted like all of the people who were giving masterclasses that day to like read through this tune, and Marcus wasn't there yet. And they were like, hey, could you sight read this like big band thing with like Bernie Dressel and like Alan Pascoe, like all these people. And I was terrified. And I like did not really read music very well at the time. And I was like, sure, I'll try. And I start sight reading this song, like butchering it, just like horrible. And Marcus comes in halfway through, and I see him come into the room, and he starts standing behind me looking over my shoulder, and he just puts his finger where I should be reading. And I was just like, this is the most mortifying day of my life.
Which
is sick. But it's good. Like, you need to have, you know, it's good to have that happen to you in high school. Yeah, it's good. You need those experiences.
That's incredible.
And I'll never forget that. But basically, we hung out the whole day. And I asked him a lot of questions about like, you know, I watched him play a lot and like got to be like, oh, well, how are you thinking about this and stuff? And we were talking about like walking bass lines, and he was like, you know, like sometimes when I'm playing, a walking line, you know, or like a two feel or something like that. Like instead of like, I'd never seen anybody play with their thumb or anything like that before. And he was like, you know, you can palm mute the bridge and kind of shape the envelope of your note and to kind of get like a more of an upright tone and kind of like get a more muted sound. And I was like, oh, cool. I've never heard of anybody doing that. So like that, I was watching him do it. And I was like, this sounds awesome. So like, I should learn how to do that. And so I started developing it literally because he was like, oh man, you should check this out. And when I was 17, otherwise I probably never would have like thought to do that. Or that was the first time I had ever thought of that. And then obviously after that, I got into like, you know, Pino and like voodoo. Yes. And like that became like more popular and or not more popular, but I just started seeing more people doing it and getting more hip to it. But I mean, for me, when I show people how to do it, like the trick is, so like on that tune, like I pluck with my thumb, my index finger, and then sometimes my middle finger, depending on what I'm doing.
Yeah.
And like, and I, the thing I always try to show people, tell people is like a lot of the time when people start doing the thumb thing or muting, they'll just choke all the tone out of the bass by just like pressing so hard on the bridge, you know, like
sure.
they'll, you'll kind of get that like
right,
tacky,
it's too much,
it's too much. And for me, I try to just like almost like barely touch the string so you still get the resonance. And then with just like these micro sort of adjustments, you can like shape the envelope of the note, you know, almost like
so
an ASDR.
Not starting. Yeah, like a synthesizer.
Yeah. So like, like that's a, that you kind of see what I mean? Like you can,
yes.
you can, that's all that it is just shaping the note and kind of getting the kind of like a more percussive thing out of the attack and controlling the release end of it. And something I like have students do when they're trying to work on it is like, if you can play like you should be able to sustain a triad and let all the notes ring through as
yes.
you're doing it. You know, if it's like, if you can't hear the notes, then like you're probably playing too hard. Unless you really
would
want
you play that,
that sound, you know, but like.
Sure, of course. Will you play the Dua Lipa line again
sure.
and play it too muted? Like what would be an example
oh, God,
of
yeah.
doing it too much?
Probably like. right. That's I mean,
right.
I, that was like comically.
Where you don't even hear the pitches.
Even, yeah. And it's funny, like that bass line in particular. I mean, that's like that line is like there's like a pulse, but it's like super improvised. And it's kind of funny, like listening to that. Cause I, with in those Pomplamoose sessions and the Pocket sessions too, like we go through songs so fast that I don't remember doing it a lot of the time, but I do remember the Dua Lipa one. I remember being like, this one turned out pretty good.
It's crazy. Yeah. And Sharon and I both freaked out over your sound. I mean, you've got this really cool muted thumb thing happening in the verse. And then we get sort of a break. There's whole notes, right? You play them up high, which is cool in the pre. And then it drops into the big chorus thing and you get this bright, crazy sound. And is that just the bass? Is it combined? Is there another instrument that's doubling that? Do you remember? Or is it just you
I
on the bass?
I think it's just the bass and how they EQ'd it. Most of those things were basically just like my Noble DI and whatever bass I had. I don't use a lot of effects on those sessions. Like the sound of like a bass with not too much on it. It's kind of
yes.
the vibe. And then usually when I do sessions in like good studios and stuff like that, I don't worry about my own compressor settings or bringing a compressor. I kind of trust the engineer. It's like they're going to kind of run whatever signal chain they want and kind of
yes.
let them do their thing. So definitely with like the Pomplamoose and the Pocket stuff in particular, like the bass tone is like a signature part of like how both of those bands sound, I think. And half of it is just like my touch on the instrument and like what I play
right.
and what I give them. And then the other half is like how the engineer wants to mix the bass and where they want to put it relative to everything else in the track, which I don't
sure.
really, I haven't really produced any of the Pomplamoose stuff. So I don't really like have a say about like how they mix it. And they just have like really great people and they just mix the bass really well. So some of the grittiness and stuff like that is mixing. And then the other thing is like I broke a string on that bass the week before and I had to put new strings on it. So it's a little brighter than it normally is.
Oh yeah.
Yeah.
Okay. So it's rounds.
Yeah.
That, right.
That
so
bass
you're palm muting on rounds.
Yeah. That bass is always rounds pretty much. For whatever reason,
got
that
it.
One doesn't really like flats. I've done flats on it before and it's a little too dark.
Got it.
That one does well when it's like a little bit brighter.
Do you, could you show us the difference? Like, I know you don't have that instrument, that, that Music Master.
Yeah. I left it at home.
Now, like you're playing this P bass. That's okay. But could, like, if you were playing that on the P bass,
yeah,
how would, could you show us like how you go from the completely like, muted approach to then that sort of like meaner, almost bridge pickup thing?
Totally. Yeah.
Seemed like that you were getting in that.
It's pretty much all about like, I mean, that's a great example, like of just like how your touch on the instrument can change, like with dynamics and like how stark of a difference in the sound you can get. I mean, like, so if I'm playing like the way the muted thing kind of sounds, like if I'm just playing it by myself muted, right? Like,
jeez, dude.
Right. I'm not, I'm playing pretty soft actually.
Yes. Like, right.
And this is something I've told a lot of students, especially upright bass players who are trying to learn how to play electric bass. The, you can get a very full tone out of the instrument without having to play very hard. And, when I'm doing that kind of like muted thing, I'm playing really soft.
Got it.
And then when I'm playing kind of like the more full attack, kind of like,
yes, the snap.
I'm
oh man, it's so cool to hear you play. Fun to hear it. It's just like we have a solo button on you, you know. It's like it's so cool.
I'm just like digging in to get the snap out of the string, just hard enough to get the snap out of the string.
Right.
And it's, I mean, it is funny. It's, I mean, you know, you guys are obviously both great bass players. Like, you know how this is, the more time you spend with the instrument, the better you get at like the difference between playing really soft on the play on the electric bass and playing really hard on the electric bass is like not that much. It's really, it's a really small difference. Especially if you don't want to like get tired. So like, I'm just like, I'm not even changing how hard I pluck the strings even that much, but that amount is like just enough to kind of get like the spank out of the top notes.
Yeah.
It's sort of,
and it's interesting. You're not like
on that one.
Yeah. And you're not like hitting ever. It seems like you're almost like, like pulling through, but you're never like approaching it like Geddy Lee or something. It feels right?
Yeah. I don't think I do that sometimes if I'm playing like a rock song or something like that, maybe. But yeah, for something like this, I don't want that much attack. And like for me, at least, when I like I feel like the bottom notes, like the lower pitches, are a little gentler, are a little more gentle than like the top pitches.
Right.
At least that's how it feels like when I'm doing it. Like when I'm doing it.
Like you're snapping the top.
Yeah.
Leaving the bottom and a little bit more round.
Yeah. And like there is something to that too about like the way that contrast feels, you know, like don't get, but don't get. You kind of like get more of the syncopated subdivisions accented that way, which is kind of, I think, what I was going for when I was doing it. And even that like attention, it's something I talk about with students a lot too, but like that attention to detail about like kind of micro accents within a passage, like, and how you're gonna, like what things you're gonna accent, like how hard you're playing certain notes versus other notes, even within like a bar or something like that. Like when I listen to a lot of great bass players, like even, I feel like people who have great touch on the instruments are always thinking about that. Like what, like how they want the whole passage to feel, you know what I mean? And it's not like a conscious thing in terms of like, oh, I'm going to accent all these notes and then not these. What you kind of just feel it or like sing through like how the whole note envelope is going to be in your head. But there is like an awareness about that, about like the touch on the instrument, like the whole time you're playing and like how each note is going to feel. And I definitely find myself thinking about that a lot, especially like on the release end of the note more than the attack end. Like a lot of the time when people talk about having good time, people talk about like where you start the note. And I find personally, like if you really want, like the thing that makes different grooves feel different a lot of the time is like how you end the note, not like how you begin necessarily.
Cut
off. Or like at least both of those things in tandem.
Yes.
And I think absolutely. Like between like the muted passage and then the thing that's like more full attack and throaty, like the release ends of the notes to me are like what makes it different as well. Not just the like I'm hitting the attacks harder in certain places. So that's how, at least that's how I react to it.
It's incredible. And as we were listening to it too, Sharon was like, oh, I've got to ask him about the end. So Sharon, you want to pull that bit up from the end of the tune?
They do. I just want to hear it again.
Yeah. Okay. Check this out.
Cowbell. Yeah, that's my favorite part. The troll cowbell is like the game winner for sure.
So good.
So cool. If someone actually transcribed this and put this on paper and they just saw the bass line, they would probably be like, well, this guy's overplaying. Wow. Because there's just so much going on. But then if you hear it, like I think if I were playing this, if I were playing exactly that, I would make it sound like overplaying for some reason. But for some reason, it doesn't sound like overplaying when you do it.
Oh, thank you. Yeah.
Do you know why?
Yeah. I mean, well, I think like, you know, and we've definitely talked about this before on like other like podcasts and SBL stuff, but like I'm a huge Jamerson fan. And to me, like this stuff is like the vocabulary I was sort of channeling on that recording was definitely kind of like modern Jamerson sort of vibes.
Yeah.
And
yeah.
For me, the way you get that to work, one, if you listen to everybody else in the band, there's space for the bass to do that. Like it was sort of decided upon, like when we were coming through that, coming up with that arrangement that like, oh, the thing that's going to push the momentum for the song is how the bass line interacts with the vocals. So like everyone else is playing stuff that's like pretty static. So like that contrast sort of allows a sort of like busier bass line to not get in the way of what's going on. If like everyone's doing that, then it doesn't work, obviously. So like, and if you listen to Motown recordings, like a lot of the time, that's how they work. All the guitar parts are like clearly arranged, all the piano parts like arranged, and they don't really change that much. And then Jamerson is like the X factor that allows things to feel like more open and driving and kind of loose and improvised in that way. So like, there's definitely like, you know, a big part of like being an improvising musician, which is like everybody who does those sessions like is you make like collective decisions without having to talk. And so we kind of had all settled on the way this needs to, the way we wanted this to feel is kind of like the bass to help propel everything instrumentally and everything else was kind of going to be more arranged. So that's part of it is like the arrangement itself lends itself to that kind of bass playing. And if people were busier, I probably wouldn't have thought to do that. You know, I would probably would have been more restrained because it just would have been too much and not felt appropriate. And then the other thing, like listening back to it, is it's even though there's like a lot of information, there are a lot of like pauses and breaks in between the ideas. It's not like it doesn't to me, it doesn't feel like a run on sentence, you know?
Yeah.
Yes.
Even like on the parts where I would like kind of go over the bar line and then hit like beat three as like the accent or something like that. There's still kind of like, if you look at the line, the fundamental role of the bass is still preserved in the line. Like I'm hitting the downbeats. Yeah. There's a relationship with the drums that like makes a complete pocket. And then like the extra stuff to me kind of like is like the sinewy fiber that like gives forward motion to everything. And when I was recording it and the way that I, just the way that I play, just like having like a kind of like improvised background is like, I listen to everyone else in the band a lot more than I listen to myself. So to me, the way I felt when I was doing it is I was trying to kind of like respond to the stuff that Natalie was doing vocally and then like have those connective phrases be in places that would like complement what she was doing. So I think like, to me, when I think about like busy bassline, when a bassline feels busy, it's because it's adding clutter, not because there's too many notes. Like Jamerson lines are great examples of this. Like some of those lines are so busy, but because of where he's choosing to put those ideas and how they're connected and the fact that they're still like, you're still hearing the root on the downbeat most of the time. And there's a relationship with the drums that feels locked. It doesn't feel cluttered. So it doesn't feel busy. And that's definitely what I was sort of channeling in that, on that recording, I think.
Well, and you know, our mutual friend, Steve Gould has this thing that he talks about, like busyness. Sometimes when people think something sounds busy, it's an arrangement thing, or it could be a time thing.
Totally.
And like your time is so lovely.
Oh,
like
thanks,
when you're
man.
Playing it's so precise. Yeah. And Steve talks about it from drum perspective as like a precision thing, that in drums, when something sounds weird or too busy or off, it's typically like a syncopation evenness issue. And so that's something I hear in your 16th note playing that is just like derived from drum world, that is evenness in your 16ths. Like when you play a phrase, it's not pushing and pulling in a way that makes you draw sort of like a you know, a side eye or an eyebrow to it, you know, it feels like part of the rhythm, you know, which I also associate with Jamerson. Mm-hmm. Like, yes, it's in the right spaces. Yes. Arrangement wise, it works. There's not a lot of clutter, but also I want to, you know, put some of the onus back upon your just like fantastic playing.
Oh, man.
It's about like your time feel on the instrument too.
Yeah. Well, thanks, man. I appreciate it. I mean, I definitely worked really hard on that stuff. Like, especially when I was younger, I have this like traumatizing memory of being in like a high school jazz combo. And we played some hard stuff in the high school combo. I went to. They had a really good program. We were playing Havona by Weather Report, you know, which is like, for people who've never heard that tune, it is just like an iconic Jaco Pastorius song composition and bass performance. And the bass line has all of this really crazy kind of like half samba, half Jamerson syncopation stuff that is like really hard to play and really crazy. And if you don't have like a really solid concept of 16th note subdivision, you just can't do it. And I was trying to do it, and I remember my band director just stopped the whole band when we were playing it. And he was like, man, he looked at me and he was like, man, you really got to work on your time. And it was just like heartbreaking. And so I was just like, no.
like in front of the band.
Yeah. And he was nice about it, you know, but it wasn't mean, but it was also just like so mortifying. I was like, oh no. And so I worked on it, just like different 16th note subdivision exercises, just every day for like a year. And it got better. But then the other thing I think I think a lot about, which as I kind of like, I talk to students about this a lot, but like there's a difference between working on your time and working on your feel, and they're related. And for me personally, like I really needed to work on like my metronomic time before I could even like grasp how it, like what it meant to like manipulate stuff with feel. Not everybody's like that, but that for me, that's like the path I had to take. And as I got older and as my time feel got better, the thing that I noticed I started listening to a lot was how different drummers would subdivide things in their hi-hat and wanting to make sure that like we were living in the same world. And like Steve Gould, for instance, is like amazing at that. Like we just did a whole run in October. And on this recording, like the way Rob is playing his hi-hats, definitely like I listen really carefully to like, if I'm going to play 16th note subdivisions and the drummer is doing it too, I really want those things to complement each other. You know?
Yeah.
And
you want to agree.
Exactly. About like, and most of the time it's agreeing about like how much swing there's going to be or like what things get accented and what things don't. And like, man, I mean, you guys know this from playing with different drummers, but if you hear a drummer play like just something like a 16th note groove like that on the hat with just like kick and snare playing a backbeat, every drummer is going to feel that a little bit differently. Even if you tell them to play like the same thing, you know?
Right.
And that's part of like the fingerprint that people have with their time feel is like those little choices that they make. And I feel like as a bass player in particular, like it's really important to like listen to the information you're getting about how that time feel feels to you, especially with regards to like the 16th note hi-hat, if you are going to play stuff that is busy, and play something that it doesn't necessarily have to fit exactly, but you want it to complement what's happening. Like you want to have an awareness of where things are sitting. And so that's something like I find myself like really thinking about a lot, or like being aware of when I play with any drummer, is like, where are they putting the subdivisions and like how much they're swinging it, or like what is it, how does it make me feel when I'm playing, and kind of trying to respond to it. So that's definitely something, like in terms of the time feel with that tune or just anything that I play on, that's something that I spend a lot of energy thinking about when I'm playing, or like being, not thinking about consciously, but like being aware of.
Well, you can tell it's marvelous.
Thanks, man. I mean, it is one of those funny things. Like, I feel like, I don't know, like so much of music is like, things get so much easier for me. Like, I feel like things get easier when you're just like really paying attention, you know?
Yeah.
Like so much of about like being in the moment and being able to improvise and be free has to do with just like being aware of your surroundings and really listening to what's happening around you. And
right. And yeah, not as like myopic into your own thing.
Yeah.
Right.
Like, I don't think about my bass playing very much when I play, you know, which I used to do when I was younger. I would think a lot about me. And like, as I've gotten older and more experienced, like I find that I like my playing the best when I listen back. If like in the moments where I like, I'm in the moment with everybody playing and I'm trying my best to like play with everybody, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
Like the more generous you can be with your musicianship in the moment, like the better the performances are usually, in my experience. And it also just like feels amazing. It like feels better in the moment too.
Well, we've got actually a really awesome example of you in the moment. This is called Modern Jazz is a Blood Sport. I play jazz.
Pretty good uniforms, so right?
Dude, where did you find the shirts?
I ordered them, and then I duct taped the Utah part and wrote I play instead.
That's incredible. Now, this is your Fender bass,
this
yeah?
Is, that's my 65 P bass, yeah.
Okay.
That this bass is kind of based off of.
Right. Wanted to do the poop emoji hat. Here's the thing. We wanted to show this because, like, it's so different from the Dua Lipa example. Demonstrates your versatility, obviously. But I wanted to talk to you. We wanted to ask you about walking.
Sure.
And about this project too. But maybe first the walking. I think, like, it can be really difficult to sound swinging and cool on an electric bass. It certainly is for me. I really struggle. I mean, I struggle on the upright too, but I think like I find it difficult to find a place and a sound in that. And then also, so I would love for you to speak to that. And I also want you to talk about a little bit how to get weird with walking, because right, like I feel like we're all taught, or, you know, I mean, I remember, you know, like, root 3-5, we're going to pass down to the next root 3-5 pass, right? And you're not doing much of that here.
No.
And right. So I'd love to talk about your approach to walking and how it applies to electric bass.
Sure. Wow. Okay. That's a big topic. So
first
thing I'd say probably about, like, you're expressing a feeling that I very much relate to about, like, how do you make electric bass swing? It is really difficult, I think. The natural attack and decay of a pizzicato upright bass is very short, and then the decay is really fast. So it's like that has that percussive natural, like, bing, ding, 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 boom, 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 boom. And you don't have to control the back end of the note in the same way, because it just decays naturally on its own, sort of, you know, when you play pits, which the electric bass, the natural decay of the instrument is so long. Like, I mean, like on an upright, you can't.
And have it just last.
Like, it's still going. You know what I mean? It's like that doesn't happen if you're walking on an upright bass, and that kind of legato, natural legato release of the instrument is like very bad for swing feel, I think, which is why it's so hard. Like, and this tune, Jacob Mann, who's the keyboard player on this recording, is one of my best friends. We wrote this song together, and we kind of, there is something about, like, if you're going to play walking electric bass, it is worth thinking about, like, what the other instruments are in the ensemble. And, like, I think this would have been way harder to do if Jacob was playing acoustic piano, if that makes any sense. The fact that it's Juno on purpose and electric bass.
It's like short.
Yes.
So short.
It, like, there's a vibe to the instrumentation of it that, like, because, like, no matter what you do, and even if you figure out, like, you know, walking bass, to me, the time feel, the swing feel, like, you know, obviously like different bass players play differently, but there's like a little bit more of a front edge and forward motion that you want to have as opposed to playing like an R&B bass line where you're sitting on where the back end, back, you know,
bit.
And
if sure.
you listen yep. to bass players like Ray Brown or Ron Carter, or like some of my favorite upright bass players, like a lot of them play kind of pretty far on the front edge of the beat. And you kind of want that aggressive forward motion. And it's a little easier, I feel like, to do that on upright bass because the release of the notes is so much more percussive. And on the electric bass, the legato nature of the instrument can kind of like make it feel like almost that the notes are sliding into each other in like a bad way, you know? And that's the hard thing to overcome. So part of it, I think, is just like the natural, like we wanted one straight ahead song on the album, and we knew it was going to be this instrumentation, and that sort of helps, you know? And then the other thing is, again, kind of like really thinking about the touch, and making sure like,
show us how you do that.
Yeah. So like, if I'm going to play, I don't know, like this tune, just as an example, like that's the first half of the form or whatever. Like what I'm aiming for, if I'm like just rhythmically, and then I'll talk about like baseline construction, is I kind of want like a pretty full quarter note, right? Like in slow motion. Like the full, like you get the full value of the note sometimes.
Yes.
Sometimes like when in trying to chase the like a shorter release of an upright bass, people play the quarter notes like super short and it feels worse.
Cut them off.
Yeah.
Right.
So I'm just kind of shooting for that like middle balance of like, there's still a full quarter note represented, but it's not, you don't hear the like elision of like the legato notes sliding into each other. They still feel sort of separate, if that makes any sense.
Right. They do.
It's like it's
and,
each.
And it seems like you're separating with, like you're playing, even in that slow example, you played with an attack that really did accentuate the front.
Yeah.
Of the note.
Yeah.
Like you're not playing super soft.
Yeah, totally. Yeah, there is a little, I do want kind of like the meat of the attack.
Right.
And it gets it close to that sort of feeling. And then part of it too, you know, I've just listened to so much straight ahead jazz that like, and like, I'm not a good upright bass player. I can play a little bit, but like, I can't really play that well, but I listen to a ton of upright bass players. Like I like,
sure,
most of my favorite bass players are upright bass players, especially in like jazz, more of a jazz context. And so like, there's also like, you start to develop a sensitivity for like which things you should accent. Like, a lot of the times in straight ahead music, like you kind of want to avoid accenting the downbeats too much, you know, like a lot of the times, like accenting the and of four or it feels better. It gives more forward motion. Like you can, you really notice it. Like a lot of jazz drummers, for instance, like my buddy Christian Newman played on this and he's one of the best drummers I know. And if you listen to him on this recording, most of the time when he's getting to the end of a phrase, and this tune, the phrases are like 14 bars or something like that. So it's like a little bit of an odd phrase. He'll go into the next phrase and hit the and of four. And every now and then, I think maybe once or twice in the recording, in the tune, he'll hit the downbeat. And you'll notice that like when you're playing like, and it's like on the upbeat, it pushes you forward. And then when you accent the downbeat, it feels like it's a break, right? It feels like, like it feels like there's like a stopping.
Yeah,
of the momentum.
Sure.
And so like when I think about rhythmically walking bass lines, like keeping track of like what's happening to the momentum of the lines rhythmically and how that's interacting with the drums. That's something that like I find myself thinking about a lot. And like even if you're playing the downbeat, I don't find myself like rhythmically accenting the downbeats that often. Or when I do it, it's like very deliberate, you know?
Yes. Yes. Yeah, you're not, because it feels like it cuts off the momentum.
Yeah, exactly. So it's like being aware, like to me, especially like something that's like an upswing like that, or like a medium up or however fast we were playing. You want the forward momentum is like the thing that I latch on to. It's like the thing you want like, to continuously like feel like it's constantly moving.
And for people that are stuck in like triad zone, which I feel like is me.
Yeah.
How like what's the first thing that you would tell somebody like me? How like a way to start to think about a walking line that doesn't necessarily have to represent every chord tone?
Yeah, totally. Okay, this is a great question. So I've worked with a lot of students about on this, or talked to a lot of people about this. Because what you're kind of getting at, right, is like, how do I make my walking bass lines feel like longer lines instead of just arpeggios with a leading tone, right?
Yes.
So what I kind of recommend to people is like, there's an exercise I've done with people. The trick to that to me is like thinking about longer phrases of lines and the direction of the line over like a longer period of time. Because a lot of the time when people are like first getting into walking bass lines, let's say they're playing a tune like Autumn Leaves or something, they'll go like arpeggio.
Arpeggio. Exactly.
And it almost like, if you were to map out the shape of it, right? It feels like a seesaw. Like it's going up and down, and it's predictable. If you're really improvising, if you're improvising like a walking bass line, right? Like you don't necessarily want the shape of the line to feel predictable because it starts to make the music feel sort of boxed in. Mm-hmm. And something as simple as like, so this is an exercise I've done with a bunch of people. Like, all right, so we're going to play the tune, like whatever tune you're working on or a blues or whatever. Every four bars, you're going to change direction. So the first four bars, you're going to go up for four bars. The next four bars, you're going to go down for four bars. And then
pitch.
Yes. Yeah. And like yes. notes, yep. Note, like what, like the literally like the note, you're going up in notes. Like, yep. So like, you know, first four bars of Autumn Leaves, like. Right. And it doesn't.
Oh, right. It creates this big arc.
Exactly. And it's not like every note has to be higher than the next one. It's just the general shape is going up. Right.
We're going up.
So you can take the same tools of like, you know, chord tones, leading tones, the chromatic leading tones, like all the same kind of basic stuff that everyone teaches you. And even just by adding this little X factor of like, you're going to think now over the course of four bars climbing. That kind of teaches you to kind of like think in bigger chunks with your lines using the same tools. So it's not like I'm thinking about, it's not like I have any other different walking bassline tools than anybody else. I'm just thinking about a bigger picture. And so like you go four up, then four down. And then the next four is you stay in the same register. And something that I notice with like a lot of people who are first getting into walking basslines is once they feel comfortable, they don't want to really use roots and fifths that much, which if you actually listen to people play walking bass lines, there's a crap ton of roots and fifths. And one of the reasons you hear stuff like that is because like they're controlling where they are in the register. So like if I go through this exercise, right? So four bars up. So like, then I'll go down. I'll stay in the same area.
Okay.
Right? You kind of see how, like, if you're staying in a similar register, what you're probably going to do is repeat a lot of notes, use roots and fifths.
Yes.
That stuff's all good. So, like, that, you want a variation of all of those different tools. Like, you can get a lot of mileage out of, like, kind of the basic building blocks of, like, oh, you're going to do an arpeggio with a leading tone, or you're going to play roots and fifths, or you're going to do this arpeggio, but go the other direction. Like it's the basic building blocks are actually pretty simple. And then once you add in the sort of sensitivity about the length of your lines and the general direction that you want to occupy with your note choices, you actually have like way more options. And it feels like you're playing stuff that's more complicated than you are, you know, because you have those long length of lines. So that's kind of how I think about it. And this tune in particular, like there's not that many, like, so like the changes, it kind of does sort of like a kind of it's like the first part of the tune, it's like all sus chords moving down in minor third. So it's like B flat sus, G sus, E, and then D flat. So like that, you're not going to get the kind of like 2-5 sounding thing. And each chord is two bars long. So like naturally the lines are going to be like a little bit, the direction of them is going to feel a little different than like what you would get just playing like a rhythm changes or like a bass, like a 2-5-1 thing, just because of how the chords move. So like, you know, if I'm playing like, right, that's kind of like a good example of like maybe something I'd play over those first like 8 bars or whatever. And there's like a mix of some arpeggio stuff, repeated notes, just going down the scale, a good healthy mix of all the stuff.
Yes. But because the progression is more obtuse than a straight up standard, right? It makes some of those choices sound even more like hip. Yeah. Right.
And sometimes if you're playing like a tune like that, that has like kind of like a little bit more like modern changes or whatever, you don't have to like mess with it too much. Sometimes just like playing it is good enough.
Right. Right.
You know, you don't have to add anything.
Because the changes itself.
Yeah. And actually, and it's like, again, like the role of the bass in a musical situation like that, it's like you want the people who you're improvising with like to be able to hear the chords, you know?
Yeah,
like you're there to, you know, sometimes I think like people who don't spend a lot of time in improvised music situations may not like always know this, but like when you're doing it, playing like improvised music with really good people, you're all doing it together. You're there to have each other's backs and stuff like that.
Sure.
And like one of the important things about playing walking bass lines is making sure the whole band is aware of the harmony, you know? And that's why your note choices really matter. Cause like you want to like make sure that like if the saxophone player you're playing with or whatever, like gets a little lost, he can just listen to you and know where they're at. You know, you're there to like play with people and be supportive. You're making all of these decisions together and like you're all in it together. So like it's I don't necessarily like I try to be careful about like if I'm going to do a reharm or substitution or play a really fat inversion somewhere, like it's in a place where it feels good and still feels supportive because the job of the bass is to, you know, support everybody.
Yeah, it doesn't feel like the rug is sort of pulled, or like you're vibing out like a gotcha change.
Yeah, that's not cool. You don't want to be that guy.
No, right. Well, I don't want to be this guy now, but I am gonna be. I hate that I'm about to ask you this, but I have to because it's so amazing to me. I'm going to ask you how to play fast. Like I was telling Sharon, I'm like, I hate that I'm going to ask him this, but I want to know. I want to see it. Pull up the Deantown, Sharon.
Oh, no, we're doing this? Oh, geez.
Yeah, man. It's crazy, man. And I think that this is valuable for a lot of people. I mean, this video got a lot of views, too. People wanted to see what this was all about. I think it's something like, it's in the title, except it's like 50 BPM faster, which I love that's in the YouTube title. Play it, Chaz. Oh, play it.
Okay, this might be the only one that we listen to where I'm like a little embarrassed by it. But that's okay. Let's do it. I didn't take it off the internet, so it's fair game.
Oh, yeah, it is. And it sounds like we sped it up.
Yeah, the reason it sounds like that is because Wolf, so I'm friends with those guys, obviously, right? Like, they released their stems. And so I pitch shifted their original stems in Ableton. And basically, I kind of just did this as a joke. And I was like, I wonder how I'll just set it to as fast as I can do it. And it's like, you can kind of hear I'm like barely hanging on. Like, this is literally as fast as I can go. And I recorded it in like 20 minutes. You know, I just thought it was funny, you know? And like, it sounds funny. It sounds like chipmunk music. That's like, it's funny.
Yeah, but it's also kind of a flex, dude.
I get it.
You're like, oh, whatever. It's funny. That's even more of a flex. You're like, oh, whatever. I just recorded it in 20 minutes so fast.
I don't know. I just thought it was funny.
It is funny. But it's also ferocious.
Oh, okay.
It's a combo. And that combo is potent. The combo of comedy and ferocity is potent.
Yeah, I mean,
that's what we're hearing here.
There is something about like really chopsy music that is just sort of, it is sort of funny. I comically went like probably a little faster than I could actually play it just for funsies, you know, just like, I didn't, you know, it's like, it would have been a little boring if it was like totally, if I felt like totally comfortable, you know?
Yes. Like it's like too much of a flex if you're like, look at how fast I can play this. Yeah. Like I can tell that you're on the edge of your ability. And I love that you did it. It's amazing. And like I say, it shows like you're comfortable, you're relaxed, you're playing this thing freaking fast. And I want to know how. I want to know how.
To add to that question with the speed, my question specifically for this song as well, because the section I struggle with is the endurance.
Yeah, totally.
Yeah, speed and endurance. Yeah. Sure.
It's definitely playing 16th notes like that is not easy. I think that the trick, so the first thing I'd say, and this is a tip I give a lot of people, is, and it almost kind of like, this kind of goes back to what we were talking about at the beginning about touch and how much you can get out of the instrument with a light touch. The only way to play this fast is to play really light. Which just seems counterintuitive physically. And most people, like including myself, when I was like trying to get into chopsy stuff when I was younger, especially because it was a lot more important to me then than it is now. I would try to like dig in. You like people like the instinct when you want to play a lot of fast things is to brute force it, which is like the opposite of what you should be doing. Yeah. You know, like if I'm playing like, God damn it. Like I'm not playing very hard and I'm playing like right on the tips of my fingers. Like,
yeah.
Right, like
that is insane.
Like, and if I dig in too hard, like you can hear the time starts to get uneven.
Yeah,
the tone gets throaty in a not good way. Like, I can't keep that up. Like, the only way you can do it is find that little sweet spot where you're like your fingers pluck the string with minimal necessary force. Like, I feel like a lot of bass tone is about like finding the point of like minimum necessary force, and then like maybe you go beyond it if you want a different sound out of the instrument, but like if you can find that place, like you'll always feel comfortable when you play.
It sounds so cool when you play that way. I mean, it's like so even. It sounds like that track. It's crazy, man.
Thanks, man.
You have such like a, it just sounds like you're on a highway of 16th notes. It's wild.
And then, so like the way I kind of, I don't know, worked on it for myself, it's like, and it goes back, this is actually what I did when my band teacher in high school told me I had bad time. But what I would do is go through like a circle of fifths exercise, like with a major scale or whatever. And what I would do is start at like 60 beats per minute and just play 16th notes on each note. So like, and go through the whole scale in the key of C. I know that was faster than 60 beats per minute, but, and play like 4/16th notes every time it changes a note, right? So, and play as evenly as I possibly could with no accents. And that's really important. Like, because a lot of the time people will add accents to things subconsciously. And so like, I try to get people, I show the students like, make sure there's no accents and everything is as even as possible. Everything is exactly 1/16th note long. Like your quarter note is split into four even notes.
Yes.
No accents, because you need that baseline for the subdivision to move the subdivisions around and to speed them up. Right.
Got it.
So, and for me, it's like you start super slow because so you really, you really figure out like how many notes there actually is in a quarter note, you know, and you just can't do that fast. You have to do it slowly. And then what I would have people do, and just what I did, is I would start in the key of C at like 60 beats per minute and then go around the whole circle of fifths. You can either go by fifth or by fourth. So you can go like C, F, B flat, or you can go C, G, D. It doesn't really matter.
Yeah.
But every time you change keys, you increase the tempo by a certain number of, by a fixed number of BPM. So like I would always do it like, it's good to start with just like maybe 2 BPM so it doesn't get too fast. Just as like a warm-up exercise, I usually do 5. So like, by the end, it's like 120 and you're doing 16th notes. And by the time you get to the end, like you figure out the muscle memory of like splitting the notes and not overexerting yourself. And like, I would just do that every day for a while. So it's like over time, you really get that sort of like natural ability to split each quarter note into four even pulses with no accents. Yep. And you figure out the way to like have your hands relate to the strength, so you're using the minimum necessary force to do it. And then there's other things you could do on top of that. That's just like the beginning, but that's like a really good way to get started. And it's like a great warm-up exercise. I like doing it with major scales, like 2-octave major scales, because it like gets your left and right hand talking to each other. You can do it with open strings too, but it's better, I think, if it's more like playing a bass line or something like that, where you need the hands to talk to each other. And that's what, so to me, it's like bass technique is so much about like how your left and right hand speak to each other, you know, to make like a note and a note envelope. So that's kind of like the exercise I run through with people when they're trying to get like their technique together.
Will you just run us through like a slow version of a 2-octave? I mean, I know it's,
sure.
It's
okay,
so simple,
no, of course.
But would you just like a slow 2-octave scale, like where your starting point?
Totally. I actually, so I went to USC for music school and my teacher there was Alfonso Johnson. And if you, the cats who don't know Alfonso, he's an amazing bass player. He was the bass player in Weather Report before Jaco. He was in the he was in that George Duke band with Billy Cobham, and he played on a million yes. amazing recordings, and he made everybody. And it's funny, Sam Wilkes and I both went to school at the same time and both did this with all, we had the same bass teachers and everything. So we both did this.
Cool.
Which is probably why like our playing is like kind of similar. We had the same scholastic environment, but
yeah, cool.
He had everybody do these like really specific 2-octave major scale shapes, which is like not an easy, like playing 2-octave scales on the bass is like not, there's not like an easy way to do it or like intuitive that's way right. to do it. Like
on a 4-string, yeah, especially, like, yes.
Everyone knows that, right?
Yes.
But usually what people do is something like that, where right. they'll go all the way across and then up 1 string. And Alphonse's whole thing was like, no, man, the best way to shift on the instrument is think about like going up the instrument diagonally. So like going from, if you're going from here to here, going like this way, if that makes any sense. Yeah. So the fingering he would show us was more like, starts the same, but then you shift with your first finger on the A string.
Cool.
And if you kind of see how I did it, like I can do it again more slowly, but it kind of shifts up diagonally and then shifts back down diagonally in a different way. And what it kind of gets your hands used to doing is playing like a scale sound or a key center kind of in every position on the bass.
Yeah.
Right. Oh, cool. So like,
yeah.
Like even if you're just looking at that, like this half of this, like you're playing in every.
Yeah. Second finger, first finger and fourth.
Like
finger,
every possible right? place B flat exists in every position between those two notes, wow. which is like really great at like opening up the fingerboard in terms of like knowing like how to travel. Cause I find like a lot of people, like they'll feel comfortable like here or here. And then this area is like a question mark.
Yeah.
Like
yeah.
And shifting between positions is often like the thing in terms of people's fingering they like struggle with. And for me, like
will you do the slow 16th thing up and down once?
Yeah. So it would be something like this, like. Like obviously I wasn't really like playing that like super in time or there was no click or anything, but that's kind of the vibe.
Yes,
and
right.
you know, when you do it as a warm up, it like, I don't know, probably takes like 30 minutes. That's like exactly the amount of time you want to be doing something like that. And then you, for me, it was helpful to do that. And then like you move on with your day and you do other music stuff. But if you do it every sure. day, it gets better. Like it gets a lot better pretty fast, you know?
I got to get on it. Man, that sounds awesome. That's very cool. Hey, how about this? Sharon, let's pull up the solo.
Sure.
With Scary Pockets. You play in Scary Pockets. And man, I got to see you guys when you came through Minneapolis. And you started to take this solo on the road.
Oh, yeah.
That turned into this moment. And it's so fun. And again, it's this demonstration with you of like, the ferocity
oh,
and the comedy.
Yeah.
You know, it's the combo of those two things, and it's so good.
I didn't know somebody put this on the internet. That's funny.
Oh, they're so accommodating, Nick. That's your Alinto.
Yeah.
Yep, let's mic the bass. What's Swati saying to you?
I don't remember. He's usually just yelling like random stuff.
Oh, you have to be hydrated.
Yeah. No, that's not a, that's booze, I think. No, that's water. That's water. The other one was booze.
And,
yeah.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah, the hat turn. I feel like they should be peeling you grapes.
Yeah. For a scream if you love Nick Cave.
I mean, it's wild. How you get back to, check this out. Oh, like you take that zaga-daga-daga-daga-daga-daga, right? And it makes the drummer, right? Yeah. Like push that with you. It's such a, it was an awesome dismount out of that solo. Man. I mean, like, you know, we see the silliness,
yeah,
right? And we talk and, you know, and we're like commenting on that. But then behind it all is this like really lovely solo that you're playing. So I guess, man, how do you, like when you're soloing on the bass, mm-hmm. what are you trying to say? What are you trying to say when you solo?
Yeah, I just like try to, you know, I think like any improvising musician is like, it kind of feels probably feels sort of similarly where you're just trying to like express yourself through the instrument. I'm just trying to like sing what I play, just like come up with melodies that I think are cool in the moment.
Yeah.
And, you know, I've given like little master classes about this on SBL before, but I literally like in my head, I'm like singing what I'm going to play. And like, that's what really? I try to do when I improvise, you know, to me, what like practice is about is like getting different sounds in your ear and like getting your hands to work so that when you hear something, you can play it without having to think about it, you know?
Yeah. Yep.
So that's kind of like, in terms of like what's in my head, that's kind of what I'm thinking about. And just trying to express like different sort of colors or things like that. I mean, like, you know, like I played on that one, like that whole tune, it's like all different dominant chords. So like I was sort of playing, listening to it, I was like playing with like different colors or different kinds of dominant chords. So sometimes I'd play like some kind of like whole tone ideas or things that are like more bluesy or like Lydian yeah. dominant kind of stuff. Like you'd kind of hear me play like, right, like on the B flat a lot of the time, kind of more bluesy vocabulary yes. or like yep. kind of something with like the dominant with the sharp four.
Yes.
Or like sometimes like I would play, you know, like a kind of more whole tone yeah. augmented whole sort tone-y. Of shape.
Yes.
But even right. like, I mean, I'm just doing this for, as an example, but like, obviously I can't sing, but like very well, but that is what I'm doing in my head. Like, I'm not just thinking like, oh, I'm going to play this shape that I think is hip. I'm actually here like,
right.
like it is what's happening.
Yeah, it's in you. You're hearing it.
I'm just trying to use like the tools that I have and the colors that I like and just like make yes. a statement. And then the bit part of it is like over the course of the tour, like it started because I hate being at the front of the stage with like the burning passion of a thousand suns. It's just like, I hate it. You know, it's like, I'm a bass player. Yeah. I feel good by the drums and the bass at the back of the stage. It's my safe place.
Right.
I don't like it at the front. It's like not a vibe. It's not my vibe. And so in like my perfect world, I never solo at the front of the stage, but the bit started with like, Ryan would force, he was like, dude, it's your solo, go to the front of the stage. So it started with that.
You.
And yes. then I don't remember who did it first, but like I was playing and I think it was probably Swati was like, do you want me to put whiskey in your mouth while like right now? And I was like, okay. And he did. And then the whole audience was like, yeah. Cause I don't know, like people like, turn, I guess, you know, people like public drinking spectacles, it turns out.
yes.
And so it just kind of became a bit to kind of see like how many things they could do to distract me while I was playing. It's kind of turned into a bit about like, how hard can we throw you off your game while you're trying to play? And like, it's pretty funny.
It's so funny. Well, and you know, so we've got you soloing here, right? But then there's also, I feel like we have a great clip of you supporting a solo. Mm-hmm. And it's so cool to hear you in both roles because it's similar, I feel like, to the Dua Lipa thing that we started with, where you are somehow able to support but also play really interesting things. You're not supporting by playing less necessarily. And I just want to, I want to get your take on it. I think it's with Ariel Posen. On a thing you did with Pockets. Sharon, can we pull that up?
Is it the session with Abe and is it that band?
It sure is.
That was a really good one.
So cool. Yeah. I mean, like, what's it like to play bass with Abe Laborial Jr.?
He's really good.
yeah, he's so good.
He's really good. I mean, if you're really in the present and like paying attention to what's happening with you, like I do the same thing I do with every drummer. I listen to what they're playing and I try to play something that I think is going to compliment them. And like,
and you respond.
And with good yeah. musicians, like there's no brick wall with communication. You know, you're just like, you can tell when someone's listening to you and when you're listening to them. And like, so you kind yeah. of form an immediate vibe. And so like, this was a very, in that sense, it was a super easy session. Cause like Abe's an amazing listener. I mean, everybody in this rhythm section are amazing listeners. And like, so you just like listen to each other and try to make something cool. And then with good people, like the vibe is just immediate. And you don't have to, you know, I mean, that's one of those main things about musical communication. Like once you get good at it, it like kind of feels like magic. Like you can just talk to anybody and like you always feel like you can converse with people. Like, and there's you don't have to plan anything out. You just do.
Absolutely.
Stuff.
And when people that aren't well versed in it say, how long have you guys been practicing together? And you're like, no.
Yeah. It's not how it works. Yeah.
It's not how this works. Yeah.
And so like the vibe was just immediate. So with everybody and
this is a really cool example of that immediate vibe. And you can tell. I mean, just that moment, right? And again, it's like you're playing a lot in there, but it all feels like in service of the momentum.
Yeah, totally. I kind of do the same thing I do when I'm improvising bass lines, right? Like this is, so in the section before, you can kind of hear like I'm sort of playing a part, right? Like.
Right.
Right. And so solo sections to me a lot of the time, like if you're playing over a, you know, like a chorus to a song where there's like a singer, like it sometimes is a good idea to kind of like restrain how much you add. So it like feels like a cohesive groove, right? Yes. So that's kind of, I think, more my approach in the chorus. But then like when the solo happens, right? Like there's those hits and then it goes up a whole step. In those kinds of songs, like the solo section a lot of time is there to like kind of open up the song and make it feel more free and less constrained. So I do the same thing that I do when I'm soloing, when I'm accompanying and coming up with like, have the freedom to have like a little bit more interaction with the soloist or the drummer is like, again, I just like try to sing everything I play. So like, and it's to me, it's like, if you listen to it, like this definitely comes from like a jazz thing where like the difference between like if you're playing a walking bass line, like if you listen to a Ray Brown bass line or something like that and a Ray Brown solo, like they're both improvised. The function of each thing is different, but you can tell that he's kind of like, it's the same process is happening. You're just changing your role in the ensemble. And so like, to me, that's how I feel when I'm like playing an accompaniment to a solo where there's a lot of, where there's the freedom to have a lot of interaction. And that was kind of the vibe on this session. And it's sort of what I was thinking of. So I was trying to like play something that was related to the original groove, but then could kind of like be a little bit more playful and open. That's kind of like what I was thinking. And there's like such a specific swing in the drums too. Like in terms of what we were talking about like like playing stuff that relates to like how things are being subdivided. Like, you know, like there was so much room to play with like where things were going to swing and how things were going to hit.
Yes.
Yeah.
And you mentioned a couple times too that like, I want to bring this up that it's not like you have a swing feel and everyone is going to move to that. Now you may, but you keep talking about this thing of like, you're listening to drums, you're listening to ensemble and you're amending, you're moving toward versus like, hey, here's where I'm putting it.
Yeah.
Right. Because a drummer, you have to move toward them.
Yeah. I mean, right? Like hopefully I'm very lucky in the sense that like, I mostly play with amazing drummers where the time feel is going to be as a conversation. You don't have to authoritatively put down the time. That's like a thing that I feel like I have to do if I'm playing with someone who's like a little less experienced where there's not communication about the time feel. Like in my perfect world, the relationship between the bass and the drums is always a conversation. It's not like, this is what I'm doing, adjust to me now. Like, that's I don't like playing music that way, you know? Right. I've only played music that way when I feel like I have to, because otherwise the wheels are going to come off, which is not a situation I've been in very much recently, which I'm like very happy about, because that's not fun.
No. You're just in like survival mode.
Yeah. And also like, you know, we haven't talked much about this, but like most of these examples have been kind of like in situations where it's very live and there's not like tracks or a click and you're not playing with pre-recorded stuff that like dictates what the time feel has to be. Like when this is one of the things I, you know, like about not playing with tracks and stuff like that, is like you can take a more holistic view about like where the time feel is going to be with the people in the room, as long as everyone is like good at that. You know, when you're playing to like sequencers or click tracks or things like that, sometimes you have to be a little bit more square about how you relate to it. Not always. Like the Dua Lipa thing, we tracked with a click, I think. And it doesn't really like, you could, I mean, it, you wouldn't necessarily know either way, like, because of how we're treating it. Like sometimes you can just treat the click like it's another instrument. And like, that's how I like to do it most of the time, because then it like feels more musical. But there are certain situations where it's like, you know, if you're on a big pop gig or something like that, where it's like, there's a pre-recorded synthesizer track that's been quantized. It's like, okay, you don't have that much room to affect the feel of the song. It's kind of already
there
for you.
It's telling
It's telling you. Yeah. You have no
say. It's saying, this is it.
This is it. Which, as someone who comes from like kind of like a more liberated playing background, I find that to be restrictive sometimes. But in a situation like this, you know, like that recording, like no click, we're just playing live, totally live. That conversation about like where the time feel is always a conversation. And when it's good enough people, it's not just a conversation between the bass and the drums. It's a conversation between everyone in the band at all times. And that can like change over time. Like, you know, some of like my favorite recordings from like the 60s and 70s, like, they'll like speed up or slow down a little. The thing that makes it work to me is that they're always kind of having a conversation about where the time feel is going to be together. And like, if you don't have that and it starts speeding up and slowing down, then it like, it sounds like a mistake. But if you're all talking about even not 60s or 70s recordings, like if you're talking about like garage rock bands that like sound bad, separate, but amazing together, you know, like that to me is what's going on, is everyone is having like a conversation about where everything's going to go together. And like, you can have like, then the slop is good slop. And you want it. But then when there's like confusion about where things are going or people aren't on the same page, that's when it like starts to turn into not things are falling apart, you know? And like the difference between that is kind of subtle. And it takes it took me a lot of experience to figure out like how to do that.
Can you tell us about this bass?
Yeah, totally.
Tell us about this gorgeous bass that you're playing.
Yeah. So this is an Alinto P bass. It's modeled after my 65 P bass that I just will not travel with because it scares me. And for those of you guys who don't know Alinto, it's an amazing company that makes like vintage style Fender basses. And I think they make like the closest thing to like a real vintage bass that you can buy that's new, which is a feeling I've always wanted to be able to bring on the road with me. They made me this bass. It's incredible. It's like my main touring bass right now, especially with stuff where it's like I need a P bass. It's like I prefer like the kind of 60s style with flats is sort of my favorite sort of P bass sound, and this just like nails it. Like in a blindfold test between this and my 65, I'm not sure I'd be able to tell the difference.
That's sweet.
And
you mentioned too that that one can get low, right? Like
the action. Yeah, this can get set up like to fusion in a way that I was not necessarily expecting, you know? I mean, you can set up 60s P basses to go pretty fast, but this can get like, this can go really fast. And it's really light too. It's a little lighter than my vintage one. It can be set up to go a little faster. And there are a couple little like modern creature comforts, like, you know, you have the hole to adjust the truss rod, which so you don't have to take the neck all the way off. Like, it's a phenomenal bass. They make great jazz basses too.
And you're running Labella flats on it?
Yeah, these are the low tension flats. And they just came out with a new like Alinto, because like a Labella and Alinto, they're partner companies. Labella just started making like a set of flats for the Alintos that I got to play at their shop last time I was in New York that are really cool. I've kept the low tension on this. They gave me a pack of the new ones that I got to try.
Mitch,
yeah, exactly.
Right?
Yeah.
Yes.
And I just haven't put them on this bass yet, right? This bass is feeling really good with these flats, and I kind of don't want to mess with it right now.
Yes.
But, you know, I try not to change the strings until they break or like unwind. And dude, I remember the first time I bought my 60s P bass on Reverb and I just never changed the strings. I just played whatever was on there.
Yeah.
And I was at my mom's house and I took the bass out of the case, and the E string had unwound at the bridge, and I like almost cried. I was like, no, no. Cause like the feeling of new flats is like, it takes a while to break in flats for me.
Yes.
And I was just like, no. This is like the one bass I need to like never have that happen. And right. I put like a Linto low tension flats on it, and it sounds amazing. And I was like, okay. We're safe. Like, it's good.
Good to go. And then they'll just get better.
And then they just get better. Time. Yeah. And they did. And that was, thankfully, I've not broken a string on that bass in a while. But that 3-week period where you have to break in flats is just like, I really dread that feeling. And if, for me, I don't really like from the way I play, it's like, I don't like the sound of new strings. Some people like that's their thing. But for me, it's no good. So every time I have to break in strings, it always makes me a little bit sad.
Yeah. You know, like it depends on the thing. But I do like rounds, especially once they've had a little bit of time.
Me too.
To sort of settle.
I feel like rounds sound the best, like 3 weeks, like 2 or 3 weeks. They have the perfect amount of life left in them. And then after like a month, after like a couple months, then it's like, they're a little too dead.
They're a little like noodly.
Yeah.
Or something.
Yeah, they're just like a little. You can heal the dirt inside the metal coil. You're like, this is no longer cool. This is dirty,
right? Just sort of gross.
In a bad way.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yeah. Hey, when people want to play the bass and be awesome like you, what is the advice? I want to know, like, if you could give yourself a bit of advice, or you give someone coming up. Like, what's the first thing that comes to your mind when someone's like, I want to be awesome at the bass?
I think the first thing, and I've definitely said this a lot over the course of this kind of podcast, but I think for me, this was like the moment that like, where I feel like I kind of came into myself. It's like learning how to just be like totally present in the bandstand and really listen to what's happening around you. Like, I think we all have this feeling, you know, as we're learning how to play the instrument, stuff like that. And I definitely relate to this, where like you start getting better, you start being able to do more. And then you kind of go through this period where you really are thinking too much about yourself. And like, even if you think you're serving the music or something, you're like overanalyzing everything that you do because of like, instead of just being present in the moment and really being a conduit for like what's happening around you, or what song you're playing on, like makes you feel, and then responding to it. Like when I feel the most inspired, like that's the place that I'm in. It's like a place of like perfect awareness, where I feel like I can like communicate the best and like compliment what's happening the best. So I like, to me, like when I work with students and stuff like that, and like I, you know, it's a really hard thing to like, it's one of those things that I think everybody has to arrive at on their own. You can't really show anybody how to do that. You just kind of have to like try to point people in the right direction. And I think I was lucky. Yeah. I had really good teachers who pushed me in that direction without like, with the right amount of instruction. Cause it's like something you can really only ever talk around until you experience it for the first time, you know? And then once you experience it for the first time, you try to figure out like how to be that way all the time. And that's like, I think like, you know, I don't find like, I think like people, as they get older and more experienced and play more music, like the people that I really respect that I hang out with and talk to, it's like when I hear them talk about like music and how they're trying to get better, that's what they're talking about a lot of the time. It's like, they're not focused on, sometimes people will reflect on technique and stuff like that still. It's not like that, that goes away. But what people are really looking for is like, how do I be in that perfect moment of self-expression with everybody? Especially in improvised music.
Yes.
And like, that is a mission that people often fail at, but it's like about the attempt, you know? And so trying to be in that place as much as possible. That's like my goal as a musician, probably.
Well, and I don't know about you. For me, that comes from preparation. I don't play a lot of like fully improvised sets, but when I'm playing with an artist, it's about how much on lock I have parts, sounds, et cetera.
Totally.
And if I have that stuff together, then I find that I can look around, I can enjoy the performance, the band, I can respond. Then I have actually more bandwidth.
Yeah.
For improv, if something zags, you know, or zigs, I can go that way as
totally.
Well, because I don't feel locked into something because I've done the work.
Yeah. And I think too, it really depends, like that feeling is sort of an abstract thing. And the amount that like you need to prepare needs to be set in advance, like depends on the kind of music. I had a very revelatory moment. I saw Blake Mills and Jim Keltner and Larry Goldings and Pino Palladino all play like a set at this like a bootleg little club in LA. And yeah. I remember it was the first and only time I've ever seen Pino Palladino live, who's like in my top five bass players, you know, and, I mean, yes, as many people would say, yeah, but absolutely, his playing had a big influence on me. And I was watching him play very intently. And, you know, Pino can play a lot. Like he has chops, even if he doesn't use them.
Yes, he does.
And I was probably like 24 or something like that, maybe 25, like mid 20s. And it was, he played pretty much whole notes the entire night. And it was the best bass playing I've ever heard. And I remember just walking away from that and just being like, oh, fuck. Like, that's what I have to do. Like, I shouldn't worry about chops so much. Like, not that I feel bad about having facility or like the time I spent with all doing all the technical stuff. But when I really think about a lot of the bass playing that's inspired me and makes me go like, wow, that's amazing. The older I get, the more it's like someone really playing the shit out of a whole note. And like having the whole note, like feel like there's an entire universe inside it. Like, ugh, man, if I can get to that point, like I'll be happy, you know? But I guess you don't know if like, you ever get there. Like I'm sure Pino doesn't think he's that, you know what I mean? But like, that's how I feel when I hear it. And it's just like, I just remember they were just playing, like they would play ballads and like, he'd be like the a whole note with the perfect touch and the perfect place. And it's just like time and space opens up and you're like, oh my God. Like to me, that's the best bass playing.
Yeah.
That's like what I want to do.
Making the whole ensemble sound incredible.
Yeah.
I felt that way about the first time I saw Victor Wooten play with Bela Fleck, actually. Like I remember him just holding these notes over, you know, and everyone on top and thinking like, and then his solos are wonderful, but like the basics, the very like fundamentals.
Yeah.
Of his playing are so strong.
Yeah, it's amazing.
And that surprised me. Like, it surprised me that I noticed it.
Yeah.
I was in my 20s as well. Yeah. I'm thinking like, oh, that's really lovely.
Yeah.
You know, and then go home and still try to work on all the craziness.
And it's funny, man. I had a teacher in high school. I briefly took upright bass lessons in high school before I realized it was too hard for me and that all the other upright bass players I knew were already so good that I would never catch up to them. And it's, I should just stop, but which is what I did. But I remember like making a joke about shredding and he was like, man, you know, sure. But when you get older, what you really want to go learn how to do is play a whole note really well. And I was like, oh, sure, whatever, man. And
old man.
Totally fucking right. You know, like,
it's true.
Man, like, the older I get, the less I care about that stuff. And when I listen to some of these, like you mentioned Victor Wooten, like some of these amazing bass players, like I got to hang out with Marcus again very briefly at a festival in Europe, like a few months ago, which was very awesome to see him again. And I told
did
him that
you get to tell him about
I did. Yeah, and did he was just like, oh man, that's cool. And I was like, dude, you don't even, you know, but you don't know what this did for my life. But it was really cool to hang out. But I got to see him play again, which I hadn't seen him play in a long time. And like, when I think about people like Victor and Marcus and like Hadrian Farode, who's a buddy of mine, is another great example of this. Like people who have are really well known for their facility and their solo ideas and their chops and just these monstrous ability to like play this crazy technical stuff. When I hear those guys play, the thing that being 32 now that I'm geek out about more than that is like how they accompany people. Something that I really admire about a lot of my favorite bass players is they have this ability to like go back in the tradition and like have very well-versed vocabulary. And then they expand on the tradition of their vocabulary in like really imaginative ways that doesn't necessarily have to do with chops. Like some of the, when I listen to like Anthony Jackson or like Tim LaFave or like Pino or like, I'll hear them play something and sometimes it's fairly simple, but I also like, I'll hear them play it and I'll be like, I can see how this comes from Jamerson world, but I have no idea how they thought to do that. Like, how did they hear that? Like, I don't know where this comes from. Like that feeling is like of originality, like, in terms of like line construction and phrasing and stuff like that. It's like, I mean, dude, it's like you listen to some Anthony Jackson stuff and you're like, I don't even know where this is coming from. Like where, seriously? Like who did this before? Yes. Like, you know, even when it's busy, it's like, it's not Jocko or Jamerson busy necessarily.
Yeah. No,
it's like its own
it's
thing.
Very
like,
different. Yes.
And that feeling of like, wow, like that to me is like, that's a special, when you hear people do that, like that's like a, That's an amazing thing. I mean, I don't know if anyone ever feels like that about themselves. I certainly don't feel like that about myself. So I know where all my bullshit comes from, you know?
Well, but yeah, I'm sure everybody kind of thinks that about themselves. I mean, you'd have to be like a sociopath to be like, oh, every idea I play is so original and wonderful. But I was, just as you were finishing that thought, I mean, I think that about you.
No, well,
like when I hear you're playing, man, I do. And, you know, you have a signature and a thumbprint. I mean, I've told you this before, but when I saw you in Minneapolis, I was so intrigued by hearing you live. It's so different on a recording, but hearing you in a room, your dynamic, even within a bar. And you even mentioned this, yeah, of like thinking about dynamics and thinking about your feel and length and stuff inside of even a, yeah, bar or an ostinato. It was so engaging.
Yeah.
And your level of dynamic in your playing was just really inspiring.
Oh, thanks,
and
man.
I was like, man, I like went home and was just like looking at my right hand, like thinking, God, how do I?
Yeah. I mean,
so it's there. It's,
yeah. Well,
you have it too.
Thanks, man. I appreciate that. I mean, that's what I want. That's like what I want to do that. So, it's very flattering to hear that, but, I obviously don't feel like that being me, but
yeah.
It's very nice. I, you know, it's funny. Like, it's the last thing I'll say about that in particular. Like, I remember, Theo Kasman and I were doing some gigs together in LA, and I remember we were talking about bass because Theo plays everything. And Theo's actually a very good bass player, and most people don't know that.
I believe it. Scary.
Yeah, it's a little messed up how good he is at everything. Yeah. And I remember we were talking about this, and he was like, "Man, you know what's cool about the bass is it's like playing drums on a guitar." And I was like, "Yeah." And like when I play funky stuff, like I think that's kind of what I want to feel like. And in an alternate life, I definitely would be playing drums, you know?
Oh,
I think a lot of bass players feel like that, right?
I would imagine. Oh, I feel that.
Yeah.
My parents just wouldn't let me have drums.
Yeah.
Nick Campbell, where can people go to check you out? What's the best place where people can go to support you?
Yeah. So I'm Nick Campbell Destroys on all the internet stuff. I have two records out. I have a YouTube channel with some music on it, Instagram. I have a TikTok, but I don't use it because I'm not a fan. It doesn't work for me. Don't like Twitter. Don't have that. But in the internet generally, you can find me at Nick Campbell Destroys. I'll be out in April with Scary Pockets in the States. And then, yeah, we're still at the beginning of the year, so I'm not sure what my touring thing looks like right now. I just got engaged actually last week, which is cool.
Congratulations. Yeah. I saw that on Instagram. Thank you. That's so awesome. So,
it's nice to have a little personal time. My fiance is also a musician. She plays cello with the Jonas Brothers right now. So she's touring a lot. And so
Power couple.
We're trying to figure out who takes care of our dog. So my touring schedule is going to be based on that. But I have two records out on Spotify, all the streaming things. I post when I'm touring and stuff like that on Instagram. That's usually the best place to find me.
Thank you. Yeah. Thanks so much for being here today. Can you take us out with something freaky and modal?
A lot of pressure, but sure. I'll just play Miscellaneous Fourths for the end.
Yeah. Yes!
Good?
Hell yeah.
Nice Picardy third at the end, right?